This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world.
Paul and Michael occasionally save the world. Occasionally.
It's a glorious day, the sun's shining outside. I survived another snowstorm, I was up on my roof breaking up ice dams, and here I am with my good friend Michael Sparkman to once again save the world, briefly, occasionally, on this one day. How are you doing, Sparky?
I'm doing well, and we had snow on the ground for one day about 3 days ago, and now it's like 70 degrees almost. that's a lot.
I think it's about 20 here. Uh-huh. It snowed 2 days ago, and driving this, I think maybe got up to the double digits barely yesterday, so nothing melted yesterday. So you have this stuff on the road that's still completely frozen snow mixed in with some sand, mixed with some freezing rain, and it just makes this slushy. It's like you know those like silica gel packets. You know, you open them up and they're all those little beads.
Yeah.
Imagine covering the road with that and then trying to drive in it. It's kind of like that because you have all this stuff that it's not frozen solid. It's this, and it's not mush because it's not melting. It's all these like frozen little pieces.
Yeah, that doesn't sound.
So it's interesting. Yeah.
I'll stick with where I live.
Yeah, you enjoy that humidity. Actually, I don't know how humid it is where you are. Texas can be pretty different.
It varies over
there. Yeah, I did not like Fort Worth.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was very humid when I visited there. Anyhow, we are here for the first time, I think, in the history, the short history of our show. We actually have three things that we both want to talk about. So we're going to kind of focus on those three things, then just wander about wherever our feelings take us. So the first thing, I have it right in front of me here. Everybody that has Netflix can quite easily go and watch this. It is a Coen Brothers movie called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. What do you have to say about Buster Scruggs?
I loved it. I loved everything about it. In fact, I've talked about it with you before you got the chance to watch it. I've blabbed about it with my cousin Dave on 2BT. I don't know. It's just that Coen Brothers sense of humor mixed with just the morbid sense of humor at times. Not even humor, this is how life is. It's not always fun and games. And almost every story, little vignette, ends in something bad happening. Except for maybe the Tom Waits one. I think he had a little bit of... maybe the most positive story in the collection, but I just loved everything about it. I'm more curious to hear what you... I know what I've said about it before. I'm curious about what your reaction to it was.
All right, so let's go through. I pulled it up on Wikipedia here so we could see what the different... Because it's basically... What is this? Six different vignettes? Yeah, six different vignettes. And as you said, most of them end on at least somewhat of a negative note. These are kind of presented as like stories in a book. So the first one, which set an interesting tone, is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And being that this was the title of the movie, I thought that Buster Scruggs would probably be a thread through the movie. I was a little concerned that this was going to be a musical because this first vignette is very musical. And then you get to the end of the vignette where Buster Scruggs is this very odd character. He sings a lot. He's very proud of that. He kills a lot of people in this, mostly in self-defense. And then in the end, his cockiness doesn't do him justice, and he gets gunned down by somebody who's better than him, which he accepts as the inevitable fate of being a gunslinger. And he flies off to heaven, singing his way up there. The other guy also is singing. It was a very fun vignette, but I was also kind of glad when he died at the end, and I realized that that was not going to be the entirety of the movie, because I think that might have been a little rough. But that one was just fun. You can say it ended on a negative note because he got killed, of course, but you could also kind of say it ended on a positive note because he lived the life of a gunslinger how he wanted to, and he got his just rewards of going to heaven.
And he accepted it. He's fine with it. Yeah, he still had a smile on his face as he floated up. Tim Blake Nelson was great. I agree. I think if it had been an hour and a half, 2 hours of just a musical, that would have kind of been a different different take on it. I don't think I could have done that. But the first time he killed somebody was such a shock, considering the way he was just smiling and singing and stuff. It really was a surprising thing. And it's like, okay, there's no telling what's going to happen here. And as a first good opening chapter. And the second one was it the one with James Franco?
Yeah, I believe it was James Franco. He was the bank robber in this one. Yeah, so he goes to rob a bank. The guy he's trying to rob at the bank, he thinks he's got him, you know, dead to rights. But the guy's kind of loco. He's pretty crazy here. So he's covered in pots and pans. Oh my gosh, it was pretty hilarious how it all worked out. This part starts off pretty funny, and James Franco ends up getting caught, knocked out, caught, and then they have him in a noose. They convicted him while he was unconscious, so obviously a fair trial, and they were going to hang him. And then a bunch of Comanche warriors come up and ambush them, kills everybody but him, leaves him to die on his own. He's still sitting on his horse in the noose. He gets saved by a guy who ends up being a cattle rustler. That guy gets away when the law comes for him, and they catch James Franco again. And in the end, he ends up getting hung for being a cattle rustler instead of being a bank robber.
Yeah. I love the line when he's up there the second time to be hung. And the funny thing is, I guess it's ironic that he didn't really deserve to be hung that time because he didn't know he was committing a crime. He thought he was just helping a cow guy run his cattle somewhere. The first time he did deserve it for trying to rob the bank, I guess. But he's up against another guy and he goes, first time?
Yep, the guy's sobbing away. This is your first time?
Yeah.
Pretty good. And that's another one that, it ends with him dying, but can you really call that a sad ending? I mean, he got what he had coming, and once again, he kind of seemed at peace with it. You know, he knew what he was risking. He wasn't crying. He took a moment to spot a pretty girl in the crowd and then died.
Yeah, it's that old saying, ride like an outlaw, live like an outlaw, die like an outlaw, or live by the gun, die like by the gun kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now the third one, this was the one that was pretty heartbreaking. So this one was entitled Meal Ticket. The second one, by the way, was Near Algodones, I believe. It doesn't have any pronunciation marks. I'm assuming that there's supposed to be an N-E-A on that N. Algodones, maybe? I don't know, whatever. Anyways, edit in the correct pronunciation. There's some work for you.
Oh, okay. We'll see.
So anyways, the third one is called Meal Ticket, and it is about, as it says here, an aging impresario, and he has an artist, a young man with no arms or legs, who performs Shakespeare, biblical stories, all different kinds of things. So he's an actor, but has no arms and legs. So this is the saddest story. I mean, it just keeps building it. You see how miserable kind of both their lives are, because this kid has no arms and legs, and he's performing his art is the only good thing you could say. But then when it shows you in between, I mean, he's basically treated like a caged animal.
Yeah.
You know, he's fed and taken care of, but not treated like a human being exactly.
Yeah. There's really no interaction at all. Like you said, as a person, the only time he even speaks, I believe, in the entire section is when he's on stage.
Yep. Yeah, so he's treated like a well-cared-for animal. He's not an abused animal, but he's treated like an animal, which is an abused human. And in the end, the old man who's carrying him around, he's miserable with his life because his ability to make money and live has him tethered to this person. He runs into a chicken that draws more of a crowd doing math than this young man he's lugging around with him draws. And he buys the chicken, and it's insinuated that he dumps the young man into the river to his death.
Yeah, that's the take I took on it. That was the that was the one. If I ever went back and got a chance to watch the whole movie again, that might be the section I just skipped through, because it is just, there's just nothing there except despair. And that's got Liam Neeson as the guy that's like the showrunner. And then the other guy is Dudley from the Harry Potter movies, Harry Melling, I think is the name. And I didn't recognize him at first, but then it's like, oh, I know who that is. And
yeah, I wouldn't have known except my wife told me.
Yeah, that was a low point in the show. It's kind of a low point in the show, but then it got kind of picked up again when it got to the next section, though.
Yeah, the next section was one I was most looking forward to because of the main actor in it, and that's Tom Waits. It's called All Gold Canyon, and he is a prospector who is searching for a vein of gold. And I love how they set it up. It's very meticulous, slow-paced, him hunting for Mr. Pocket. He's hunting for Mr. Pocket, digging these holes, panning, seeing how many gold flakes he gets. And he narrows it down. He finds the pocket of gold. And then right as he's getting to finding it, you hear a little bit of noise. I mean, you know something bad's going to happen. It can't just be happy. You hear a little bit of noise. A shadow comes over him. He looks back, and there is a thief that's been following him. Shoots him in the back. Sits there and waits and waits and waits to make sure he's dead. You see the blood spreading through his shirt. And finally, after quite some time, the gunman jumps down. Tom Waits rolls over, fights with him, ends up killing him. And tends to his wounds. He was lucky that it went right through him and didn't hit anything vital. And he gets his gold and gets out of there. So I liked the twists and turns of this. I liked that this one is the one that ended with a specifically happy ending, where the good guy who was getting done over turned the tables and got away with, you know, what he rightfully deserved. I think that the story before this really brought you down as low as you could go. And then this one gave you a juxtaposition where you're so down from the one before that you're expecting this one to just be, you know, end in a pile of crap, you know, like, yeah, however you look at each one, like you can look at the ones before as being negative. And I think that the meal ticket one really sets you up to just feel awful about the whole deal. But this one was definitely my favorite. I love Tom Waits, so it was good to see him. But I also liked the twists and turns, but ultimately it ending on a positive note. Now, the next one was quite good. The Gal Who Got Rattled. And this is about a young lady who is traveling on a wagon train with her brother, who dies. She's in a bind because she doesn't have the money to pay the young man that they hired to drive their train. She can't do it on her own. She ends up planning to marry one of the fellas who's driving the wagon train, who's a young guy. It's a young guy and an old guy driving the wagon train. And the end of the story, she wanders off because she hears her dog that they actually tried to kill because he was a nuisance. And she goes and finds him. He's barking at some prairie dogs all confused, and she thinks it's hilarious. But the other guy that's driving the wagon train, the old guy, the seasoned, salty vet, finds her, realizes they're in very big danger because there are Indians on the horizon. So he sets up to defend them, but he starts off by giving her a gun with two bullets and says, if they get me, you kill yourself because you don't want to live through what would happen if you don't. So he battles the Indians. Then they make another pass. It looks like he gets knocked down dead, but he's playing possum to get the last Indian that looks like he got the better of him. And so he gets them out of it, but then goes back to find that she used that bullet.
Yeah, that was a pretty heartbreaking one too. That was one of my, I think this was probably my second favorite of the stories. Just because mostly I felt like he was going to have it. The guy that she's going to marry seemed really to be looking forward to it. He's going to have some happiness in his life because he's just living out there with this old guy constantly going back and forth, escorting wagon trains. And, you know, she was going to, instead of maybe marrying some old guy that her brother was trying to set her up with, she was, actually seemed like she cared about this guy. And then, yeah, it's like that final scene was really intense where the older man that was a partner of the, trail driver or wagon train leader, he didn't say hardly a word the entire section of the, mostly it was just kind of, yeah. And he didn't really want to speak much. But when it came down to the confrontation, that's when he spoke up, and he said a little bit too much at that point. And maybe he should have stayed a little bit quieter like he had been earlier on when people would address him, because he made a convincing point and she followed through with it. I mean, yeah, that was a sad one.
Yeah, I thought it was good. It was less sad than the other one that was just so despairing. This one obviously ended bad and left you like feeling raw in a lot of places, but I think it kind of was dealing with some of the realities of what life could be like. The other one was somebody purposefully doing the most horrible thing they could do and not doing it because they thought it was the only option. So the gal who got rattled, that was possibly it's a close tie with the last one, I think, for my second favorite behind the Tom Waits segment. The last one is called The Mortal Remains. This one sees five people traveling via stagecoach. And they're all talking and showing all their characters. So this one I thought was a lot about characters and showing the different characters of the people in the coach. But then when you get to the end of it, it starts getting darker and darker. And the two gentlemen who are sitting on one side of the coach who are together, it comes out that they are bounty hunters of a sort. And they are ferrying a body to the destination. But this ends leaving you really wondering what's going on. So my impression was that this was not all that it seemed to be, and that they were the three people, not the two bounty hunters, but the other three people were dead. And the bounty hunters were something not quite normal. Right. I think they were out to, they were a vehicle of the, you know, whatever is on the other side that gets sent out to get the ones that are trying to resist going where they should go. But this was definitely like, this is one that left you feeling like it wasn't just a direct representation of what it was showing. What was your thoughts on it?
I had that same feeling that there's more to it. And my wife and I talked about it after we watched that part. And there's definitely the feeling that, like, they were dead and didn't know it. And they were, like, the guy that takes people across the river to the underworld in mythology. They were kind of like the people that were the agents of death, maybe, themselves. And there's a moment when they exit the stage, and no one really wants to get off the stage and go into the hotel because they themselves are still not sure what's going on. They feel like they're alive, but something really, really weird is happening. It's either that or they just do not want to be around these people because they seem to take a little bit too much joy in their job.
Yeah, and you also have the element where the older lady faints. And the other guys are saying that they need to stop the coach, and the two bounty hunter guys are saying he will not stop. Like, no matter what, he will not stop. And I thought that was also indicative of this being a trip that they didn't realize they were going on.
Yeah, and that's the end of it. Yeah. And I enjoyed the heck out of it. It's one of those, I know I'm going to watch it over again.
Yeah, I thought it was great. My wife and I actually watched this over, I think, three or four nights. We'd watch one or two segments a night. So it was kind of nice. It was kind of like watching a shorter run of a TV show. I think this is kind of the length of this is a little closer to what I think a lot of the made-for-Netflix type of shows should be. Yeah, I know you've probably watched a lot of the, you know, the Daredevils and those type of shows. And they're typically, if I remember correctly, 13 episodes around about that. And they really feel like they could cut a few episodes out of the middle. They just feel like they could drag in the middle. I feel like this was a really good length where you had an overall, like, arc to what happened, but it also didn't drag on in the middle where they're just trying to fill it to meet, like, a quota of length.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was looking through something and reading about it. They've been working on these stories for, according to this one source here, 20 to 25 years. And I guess they finally got enough gathered up to put it into a final thing. Those guys are always interesting me. All their movies that I've watched, they're all not always the same, but there's always a unique Coen kind of feel to it.
Yeah, I tried to start watching another Coen Brothers movie after this, but there's not a ton of them on Netflix. I forget which one I even tried to start watching, but I remember it was No Country for Old Men. I just wasn't in the mood for it. It wasn't the right feel. There is some variance to the feel of their movies, but they always have, just like you said, those kind of Coen traits in them, or they'll be a little brunt and shocking.
Yeah, that movie, No Country for Old Men, of all the Coen brothers, to me, seems like the less, it's high quality in it, the way it's made, and it was really faithful to the story, the novel that was written by Cormac McCarthy. It didn't have quite the quirkiness that you get in a lot of their other movies, like Barton Fink or Oh Brother, Where Art You? Just a little bit of a zany kind of part of it also in the story. But I recommend everything I've seen by them, though.
Yeah. So I was very eager to talk about that after watching it. I thought it was great. You thought it was great. So we recommend that to anybody who hasn't watched it. The next thing I wanted to talk about, I just finished reading also, and you were a little ahead of me on finishing this as well. And that is the series Royal City by Jeff Lemire. So this was collected across three trades, and I want to say it was 15 issues?
I've got them right here. 14.
14 issues, okay.
14 issues, yeah.
So 14 issues across three trades, and I read them by the trade, not as individual issues. And there was sort of a – you could see the trajectory of the story changing across the three trades, whereas the first one, stuff wasn't quite what it seemed, and by the end of that first trade, you realized kind of the gist of what was going on and the fact that all these different people from this family were devastated by an event that took place years ago when the younger brother of the family died.
Yeah.
And all of them dealt with it in different ways, and their lives all went somewhat different directions. They weren't completely separated or anything, but it eroded away at their lives, and they were all dealing with it in different ways. And it kind of took you a while to realize what was going on, because you kept on seeing them interacting with these different characters that weren't quite there. And what it was them interacting with their memory of the young man who had died. So the mom would go to church and see him there, and he was like a choir boy. The older brother, who would turn into like a skeezy, druggy douchebag, saw him as having aged and was right along with him doing all the dirt he was doing.
Supporting him in his bad decisions.
Yeah. The other brother, who was in between the two, had stolen his notebook, the brother who died, stolen his notebook and used it to write a book that made him a successful author. His second book was not well received, and he was stuck for trying to write a third book. So he was living the life of a fraud, and he knew it, and he was starting to suffer the consequences. He also was married to an actress who he left behind in Los Angeles when he went back to where his family was when his father suffered. I actually don't recall. I feel like he suffered a stroke. He had some kind of a medical thing happen, and he was unconscious.
Yeah, yeah. He went into a coma.
Okay, so yeah, so he was in a coma. The sister, who I'm not sure if she was the oldest or the second oldest, but she was about there. She had grown up, gotten married, kind of fought for her own success, was butting heads with her husband. That relationship was degrading. I believe they were separated through most of the story, and she saw her deceased brother as a child. So you have all these different perspectives. So you're seeing different perspectives of the deceased brother. And as you're going through this, they're slowly shedding light, particularly in the second trade, on what actually happened. And they get, the second trade ends getting to the point where he died, but without showing really the final part of what had happened, but kind of right up to it. And then the third trade picks up from there, and that's where you see what the final thing was that happened. They didn't exactly know if his death was because of mixing medication with alcohol, if it was an accident, or if it was suicide.
Yeah, and I don't think it's ever made clear even by the end of it, because there's that really hard scene when the loser older brother that always gets in trouble, has a gambling problem, and he's once again let his family down, lost all the money the sister gave him to get him out of trouble, and the younger brother is there, the figment of his imagination is there telling him just to end it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the older brother even asks, is that what you did? And there's no answer.
Yeah, this story, which is a pretty emotionally, down story, ends with glimmers of hope. Because as you said, that older brother who is just a screws up as much as possible at the end. He has his chance at redemption. The sister gives him the money to pay off his debt so he can get out of trouble. And he does everything wrong again at the end when it's supposed to be his last chance. And then, as you said, the figment of his brother is pushing him to commit suicide. And he resists through that. And the sister is still there to help him again. And you see the family all come together, and there's just a glimpse of hope with everybody. The author who had left his wife behind, and that relationship was in a real bad place, she followed him there. They met their niece, who is the son of this kid, who basically had sex for the first time with his brother's girlfriend. And then died. So he conceived this girl that they find as their niece as a young adult the day he died.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's kind of what wakes them all up and makes them have to confront what they left behind and what they were trying to hide from with the death of their brother. So they're all in kind of a different place. The dad wakes up. The mother admits to the dad that she had started an affair the day that her son died, before he died, without knowing that that was happening or anything. And she's carried on that affair this whole time, decades later. They also admit that, and this is something that was never even hinted at throughout the book until the end, that the father had met another man through losing himself into repairing these old radios. And so he actually had discovered something about himself and started an affair himself. And they both admitted that they realized the other one was doing it, and that they were actually happy for the other ones having found some happiness in their life. So that was an interesting dynamic, and seeing the father wake up and them being able to admit to each other and part of these burdens they had been carrying, part of this guilt, which I think this book has all just a ton. This book is all about guilt and what it can do to us. And so they were able to confront part of their guilt because they had been able to accept the guilt that had come from their son dying. And that kind of trickled through everybody. The writer, his wife came out because she refused to let him just walk away, basically. They kind of set up their relationship to give it another try. The sister was kind of in a better place, and same thing with her husband. Kind of there's the glimmer of hope there. The screw up of a brother, there's a glimmer of hope there because he got bailed out by his family and finally kind of came back into the fold. So this family that had just been utterly torn apart kind of all started patching themselves back together, and the only way it could happen was by them doing it together.
Yeah, yeah, they all had a big cloud and were living under the burden of the loss of that. But the girl that was the daughter of the brother that had died, was her name Olivia? Something like that. She's kind of like the savior figure in the story, in that she, her presence there brought a joy that kind of lifted them all out of this morose feeling they had. The writer, the brother that was a writer, he starts writing again after she comes back. The mother, tells the little, she goes and sees her son that died at the church. She tells him, "I'm not going to be here as much. I have to be there for your daughter." She's kind of like, she's the one that kind of gives them a little bit of redemption that I thought was a nice way to end the book. And the book, you know, when it first came out, I was listening to an interview with Lemire on I think it was Comics Alternative. It's a podcast that Jay had recommended. And you know, Lemire was really high on this project, saying it was something he planned on working on for his entire career. It's something he was going to, maybe not continuously, but he would jump back and forth into it and tell other stories. But it was interesting reading he wrote a little note, I don't know if it was in the trade, the little note at the end of the 14th issue, where he explains that he wasn't going to be able to do that. And it might have been because of sales, or I think it was also because he couldn't. Usually when he writes a story, like with Sweet Tooth, he brought up, he knew the ending. It became almost a burden to him that he was dealing with a story that had no ending. It could go on forever. And he decided to kind of call it quits with it at 14 issues, rather than just make it something that kind of had no end. But I think he tied it up nicely the way he did.
Yeah, yeah, this is one I liked it all. I read it all digitally with Hoopla, and this was three volumes. I'm hoping that they publish a hardcover collection of the entire thing. That is something that I would like to have. But yeah, I thought this was a great story. The way it ended was nice, having those glimmers of hope through a story that was such a downer. But there was just so much in this that, you know, regardless of what you're dealing with, you know, we're all dealing with stuff. And I feel like there's a lot of different threads of things to relate to in this. When I got to the end of the third trade, at the end, they had a collection of all the playlists that Jeff Lemire made for these. I don't know if you bought the issues issue by issue, if there was a playlist in each one, or by the trade.
Yeah, each issue at the back has a Royal City mix.
Okay. And there's a collection of all these playlists on Spotify. So I actually, when I finished reading it, I found that and I started listening to it. And some of it was music I had heard before. A lot of it was music I probably wouldn't have found on my own, because it was a genre that, like, I was familiar enough with, but I wasn't drawn into enough to, like, dig and find everything. But it was a lot of stuff that, like, really tapped into moods that can be hard to tap into and easy to forget. So I really enjoyed the playlists as well. But yeah, I mean, there's just, you know, so many things that we deal with mentally and emotionally as people that I feel like this really touched on and kind of gave a way to get some catharsis outside of yourself by reading this. So Royal City, I thought was fantastic.
I agree. It's definitely something I would recommend everybody to take a look at. It's not going to be something everybody's going to love, but I think by and large, for the most part, it's something that more people than not will find something they can appreciate in.
Yeah, I mean, some people just don't care for books like this that are dealing with kind of more real-life emotions and stuff. But for a lot of people, this is something that's just going to be great. Kind of like Essex County. Like, I feel like this was more in the vein of Essex County than most of the other stuff that he's done, which nothing, you know, not that anything needs to be the same. But Essex County was always one of my favorites, and it was really because that I really dove into, you know, real emotions.
Yeah, that's the thing about Lemire. I've read a little bit of, did he do a run of Arrow, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think I read a little bit of that, not much. I haven't read any of much of his work for the Big Two. I've read all of just about pretty much everything he's for Valiant, of course, and other things. But even in that work, he can't help himself but to put this some facet of just this being human. Even with Bloodshot, his attempts to find a normal life. You get what I'm saying. Throughout all his work, there's always this, he deals with pain and happiness and all kinds of things so well. And just the aspects of just what it is to be human, you know, from Essex County, you dealing with loneliness and not having the boy finds a kind of a friend in the big guy, all the way to, some of his more recent books like Roughneck, that was just a graphic novel that came out. He knows how to really hit you in the gut emotionally. And that's one of the reasons I plan on reading everything, especially independent stuff he's had out that I can get my hands on.
Definitely. All right, so now that we've talked about as much depressing stuff as possible, let's talk about some music. So this is something you had mentioned to me before, and I was kind of like, nah, that's not really up my alley. So my wife, of all people, she asked me if I had ever seen the Downtown video from Macklemore, and then she proceeded to make me watch it. Then she made me watch Thrift Shop, and then she spent most of that day with her headphones on her phone, watching Macklemore videos. That day I had run out to get, some insulation to do some insulating work. It was a very cold day and I was on vacation. And so I listened to Macklemore on Spotify while I was driving around. And, you know, my first impulse with Macklemore was that's too popular. Like I tend to have a reluctance to listen to popular music because typically I'm not going to like it too much. But listening more and more, I actually really grew to like Macklemore. Part of it is probably because it's hard for me to find new music nowadays. So something that is new and different that I've never listened to, if it catches me enough, even if it's not going to be my favorite thing forever, sometimes I'll really binge on that for a while. But with Macklemore, the more I listen to him, he definitely has some skill as a rapper. The production on a lot of the stuff is good. But then listening to a lot of the songs, like a lot of the songs have more meaning to them. And that's really kind of what drew me in is the depth to the lyrics in a lot of his work. Like a lot of his work will be poppy fun stuff, but some of it has a lot more that it's saying.
We found him when he's an extremely independent artist. He and Ryan Lewis, they did not have a big deal. He has a song about Jimmy Iovine, the big guy that's associated with Dr. Dre and a bunch of just about everybody that's had success in music has some relation with this guy. He has a song, I don't know how true it is, on the Heist, where he's like has a meeting and to go get signed by this guy, and he's like at the end of it, he says, "Nope, I'd rather." The line is, "I'd rather live as a starving artist than something like be a sellout or something like that."
I'd rather, how he says it. I believe it's, "I'd rather fail as a starving artist than get effed."
Yeah. That's a more apt way to put it, like he did. Yeah. We found him on the radio, like everybody did when he broke out. He was a huge hit. And so, of course, we tried out his album, and loved a lot of the songs on it. And then I went back, like I do, and found out a little bit more about him, got some of his older things. And it's like you said, he does put a lot of positivity in his songs. He's dealt with addiction, through his life. He doesn't hide from that. He shares that. He always kind of has like a ray of hope. And a lot of the songs dealing with sadness like that. I've always thought he's a pretty talented guy and enjoyed it. Yeah, the Downtown and Thrift Shop are like the big made for radio hits, but he has a lot more depth in his music. I mean, like that song that it was also a hit called "Same Love," that deals with marriage rights for people, like gay rights, gay marriage, and things like that. He, yeah, I'm always pleased with what I've listened to. And that guy, the Downtown, it's got a guy named Eric Nally has been on a couple of his songs. He's a singer for this band called Foxy Shazam. He's the guy that does the singing. But did you recognize some of the old rappers that he had with him?
Oh, yeah.
Melly Mel, Kool Moe Dee, Grandmaster Caz, yeah.
That's honestly kind of what drew me in and made me more open to giving him more of a chance. That video, like, not only was it a fun video, but, like, he drew in some of those, some old school, like, legends. But then, you know, the production, like, it's a super overproduced song. The video is, like, super produced and, like, but it's just a lot of fun. But one of the things I was thinking, and this is one of the things that, you know, it's easy to dismiss an artist like this easily. So I was thinking about, you know, what's the last, and I'll make this really easy to make the analogy, what's the last really big white rapper who had these really catchy singles off of his albums that had these, like, really produced videos? Like, that was huge. Eminem, right? Like, it's really easy to think back to Eminem when you look, you know, Downtown, Thrift Shop, these, they're just super easy to listen to, super draw you in. But you know what? And I haven't listened to much Eminem after maybe his third album. I never was really able to like Eminem very much. And here's why. First of all, those songs, the radio songs, are like trying to drink a bottle of syrup. It's just like, they're fun at first. They get way too much really quickly, and there's not really a whole lot of layers to get into with them. Whereas my wife and I have been watching Downtown like once a night after we put our kid to bed. We did that for like a week, and we're still watching it occasionally because it's just like every time we watch it, we're noticing other little details. It's not like forced down your throat like the Eminem stuff was. But then you look at the other content beyond that, and man, I was actually doing this recently because I hadn't tried to listen to Eminem in forever. And then for some reason, he popped up in my brain. I was like, you know what? I'm going to give him a chance. See, like, if my distaste for him was because of the place I was in where I was really resistant to popular music. And you listen to his music, and it is just full of being as awful as you can be. Like, it is awful content. Awful stuff, like misogynistic and violent and promoting just all sorts of horrible things. It's horrible, horrible music. And I have no interest in that. I know that he developed and changed over time, but when he became popular was really at a time of you made yourself popular by being incredibly shocking. You know, Marilyn Manson was huge at that time, and he was huge not just because of the quality of his music, but because he was the most shocking character he could make himself. And
well, he had a lot of rage, and of course, young people have a lot of rage, and they were drawn to that because it's like he puts out there something that they're feeling.
Exactly, yeah. So you have the, like, just all the things coupled together was a perfect storm to make him hugely popular, but also was a perfect storm to rationalize just this massive negativity he was putting out in the world. And that's why I was never drawn to Eminem, is because, you know, even if he has some talent, like, because of the fact that he's, you know, his music is popular music, there's always going to be certain sacrifices made to make it more, more listenable to the greater crowd. But just all that negativity, it's like, I didn't want any part of that. Like, you know, you listen to that stuff and it starts to make you feel that way. You listen to Macklemore and you're listening to songs that are about his battle with addiction, not about, you know, glorifying addiction. You listen to songs about how, you know, about bigotry towards gay people, not songs that are, propagating that, you know, and I mean, like, for some of his songs to be just as poppy and fun as they are, even then, like, you look at Thrift Shop, and he even addresses, like, the stupidity of spending disgusting amounts of money on fashion. I mean, yeah, it's like, it's easy to make a song about going to a thrift shop and everything is cheap and it's fun and kind of make fun of the stuff, but he like specifically addresses a Gucci t-shirt costing like $50 and how stupid that is, and how like you're allowing yourself to be manipulated and taken advantage of if you think that that's what you need.
There's that song. There's another song. I think it's the one called Wings, where he's talking about how growing up, all he wanted to do was be like Michael Jordan and have, you know, some Nike Air Jordans. And then, you know, it's a song about how that is not the way you should focus your self-worth on whether you have something like
that. Yeah, I mean, he even mentioned that that one of his friend's brothers got killed over his shoes. And, like, I remember growing up, that was a thing you heard a lot more, was people getting killed over their shoes. Nowadays, I don't know if it's that it happens less or if it's just that we're numb to it.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's got some good songs. There's a song, there's an unplanned mixtape from 2010 that has, like, a song I recommend, The Town, a song called Fallen. There's another song called Vispisana. So many good songs that you can get that are just, they're a lot more than just the pop, what's been popular. Yeah, I'm glad you, I think it was the first episode I brought him up because I just wanted to know your opinion on him. I know he seems like he's like a more popular kind of guy because he had the success, but it's something he self-made without having a lot of big money corporations pushing him, which is something I respect.
Yeah. And right now, The Heist is my favorite album of the four that I have on here to listen to. But I've listened to that a lot, The Unruly Mess I've Made. I've listened to Gemini a little less than those two. And then The Language of My World I kind of dipped my toes into. And that's definitely more indie than the other stuff. But you can also see, like, looking back through all that stuff, that he is him through all of that stuff, and that getting the success, like, he is still honest about who he is and what he is dealing with, you know? He's a very interesting artist, and, like, I still think that I'll get to the point where I over-listen to him and back off, but as opposed to some other, like, I got into Childish Gambino for a little bit because it was something that was so different. He has a lot of talent, but still, there was a certain point where I started, okay, this, like, I've listened to this enough. But the lyrical content also is something that makes me, when I get to that point, be like, yeah, I'll put a lid on that now. Because, you know, Gambino's music is a lot more crass and bass. And Macklemore is definitely saying a lot more things that are worth being said, I feel, in his music. And I haven't listened to everything that Gambino's in. Like, that newest song that the album still hasn't come out for, but This Is America, like, man, that's heavy.
Yeah, yeah. I remember my wife showed me the videos and watched this, and it's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
He's making a statement.
Yeah, I heard this song once before seeing the video, but then people were claiming, like, I kept on seeing his name in the video pop up. I was like, ah, fine, I'll watch it. And then I watched it, I was like, oh, I see why. So that's Macklemore. I finally gave him a chance, and partially it was probably because you put the bug in my ear, but then when my wife brought him up, I also, just like I was telling a friend of mine who said that he couldn't really get into Macklemore, he doesn't care for it. I said, well, you know, my wife was telling me she wanted to listen to rap, and so that's something I'm going to foster, you know, even if it isn't my favorite thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Another little Macklemore story before we wrap up talking about that. So I was driving the other day down to Tops. I'm about a, like, 20-25 minute drive away with my son, who's six. And and I've talked about the podcast, he's had developmental delays with language. So there's a lot of stuff that he'll say wrong, because when he was, like, learning to talk, he either was hearing sounds that weren't there or mishearing stuff like that. So one of the things that he says, he doesn't say music, he says b-music all the time still, and we can't get him not to say b-music. I don't know where that B came from, but it's b-music. So normally when we're driving, if he wants to listen to music, he'll say, can I listen to b-music, please? Or can you put on b-music, please? So we're driving, and my wife had left a Macklemore CD in the CD player, and I decided to let it play. It's like, I know there's some profanity and stuff, but for the most part, the profanity in his music is also, like, woven in well, so it's not that really, like, punctuated, obvious, where, like, a kid's going to pick it up and start saying it. So I was like, I'll let this play some. I'll just kind of pay attention. So I let it play for a little while. Then, you know, after a few songs, I was like, yeah, maybe I should turn it off. So I turn it off. And he goes, I want more bemusic. Like, demanding it. So I'm like, okay, turn it back on. We drive a little bit more. We're starting to get close to where I'm going to stop to get him lunch. I turn it off to ask him what he wants. And, like, as soon as I turn it off, he's like, can you put the bemusic back on? So he just cracked me up. He absolutely loves Macklemore.
That's the thing I brought up before. We liked him and listened to him, but we found, and of course, we had the, we would play Thrift Shop for Delilah, and she still to this day, and it was years ago when we introduced it to her. She still will get in the car and she says, can we listen to Thrift Shop, please? she loves the songs too, loves to hear his voice. And, that's gotta mean something when a kid can, they don't even know what they're talking about. But there's a power in it that they enjoy, which is, it always puts a smile on my face when she does that. So both our kids love Macklemore.
Yep. And you know, just like you just said, like both of us being dads, we both know, and anybody else out there that has kids, I'm sure knows that there is nothing that makes you happier than something that brings your kid joy. Like it could bring you the most joy possible. And that still cannot measure up to something simple bringing your kid joy. So, yeah. So, I mean, that's a slam dunk. Macklemore is A-okay in my household. My wife wants to listen to rap. My son is joyous listening to some of his songs. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it, too. And
I think you started the new year off at on an up right there. You're winning.
Exactly. It's a win-win-win. Can't go wrong there. So, we got a few more minutes here before we need to wrap up. I believe there were some other things you wanted to bring up.
I'm going to hold on to a couple of them. I just, like I said, finished reading Sweet Tooth. I read, and, you know, being kind of really diving in on the Jeff Lemire, I went and got his first book that he released called Lost Dogs that he did all by himself. And I got it on Comixology, and, you know, his art from the very beginning, it's a lot, he called it messier. His lines were really, really thick, but it's definitely Jeff Lemire's style. And you can even see the main guy in the book of Lost Dogs has that look of the guy from the big guy from Essex County and the big tough guy from that you see throughout a lot of his books, like a Roughneck. And it is just like I want to go back to a younger Jeff Lemire and say, dude, what the heck? You haven't read that yet.
No, man. I haven't yet. I have it. It's one of the things I purchased quite some time back on Comixology.
I told you the other day I just wanted to punch him in the face because it's just a be prepared to go find something really happy to read afterwards. I'm not going to spoil anything more than that. It's like, dude, you really want to, but he had that in him from the beginning, that deep, deep seated need to explore the depths of human emotion. And that's in a lot of his books. And it is a hard read, man. He doesn't pull any punches from the very beginning. And I highly recommend people reading it, though, if you can find a copy or get it digitally. That's one of the things I want to talk about. I got two things I want to say for next time. But I do, one big question is, we talked about reading some other stuff together. I finished Sweet Tooth. I loved it. It's another story where he, even with a zany story about kids that have antlers or pig noses and stuff like that, he's able to touch on what it is to be human. I'm either going to dive into Sandman, or I don't know what to look into. Maybe Hellboy. I don't know which one I'm going to end up starting.
So
if you've got a recommendation, I know you love the Hellboy.
I love both of those, and those are both things that I would actually like to dive back into, because Hellboy, my reading of Hellboy has been spread out over a number of years. I just, within this last year, finished reading BPRD Hell on Earth, and there's still more stuff for me to read out there, but it's been so long since I've read the earlier like Hellboy proper, and also like the first BPRD before it became Hell on Earth. And I was reading that in a way that was a little more laborious to figure out the order to go about, but now I have digital collections of everything, so it's easy. So I would like to get into that. I also haven't read through all of Sandman since I lived in California, so that's been like 8 years since I've read that. And I've read the first trade a couple of times since then, but then I always kind of get a little bit into it and then stall up. But I would like to give a nice, big, thorough Sandman read-through. So if you're leaving it up to me, I would say Sandman because it's been the longest for me. But both are good choices.
Okay, yeah, I'm gonna start my Sandman reading very soon, and maybe we can discuss a little bit of it in the next episode.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'll try to pace myself with you on that. I'm reading through as much Uncanny X-Men on Marvel Unlimited as I can before my subscription ends, but I also kind of hit that fatigue point where it's not the only thing I ever want to read, so I'm starting to mix other stuff in a little bit. Plus, it's just, life gets busy, it's hard to find time to read, and those books take a lot longer than modern books take to read. So I've been reading that. I think I'm around issue 230. I'm hoping to get past 250 at least. And I also started reading classic G.I. Joe because I started doing Comixology Unlimited. So I've been reading that, and I'm going to do that a little slower pace while listening along to that G.I. Joe podcast I was telling you about. I don't know if you checked that out. Let me actually look up the name real quick. It's called Talking Joe.
I think Talking Joe, and it's from UK, yeah. Right?
So at the very least, you get to listen to a couple of guys with British accents talk.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to check that out. Those early issues were written by Larry. Is it Hama or Hama?
I always say Larry Hama, but I could be wrong.
Hama. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, he's a. I need to read some of that. I had some of that on Comixology Unlimited down
yeah.
there. Yeah. So it's about time we need to wrap it up. You got to go get your son.
Yeah, so you can find us on Twitter. I am on Twitter at Who's Paul. You are at MD Sparkman. You can find your other podcast, 2BT, on the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. I also have a new podcast. We are recording our third episode tonight, the Shell Shock Podcast, a TMNT podcast, with Joey Galvez, who is also represented elsewhere on the Nerdy Legion Network. So yeah, check us out. And yeah, I guess that's about it. Been good talking to you, Sparky. The sun is slowly receding. This is an appropriate timing to wrap up as it gets dark and cold outside here in Maine.
We'll try to stay warm.
Send some of that warmth to melt this snow. All right. Have a good one, and we'll catch y'all later.
Bye.
That wasn't terrible.
That was pathetic. Boo.
Nerdy Legion.
NerdyLegion.com.